world was truly poised to develop a theory of probability. Still, despite the handicap of an awkward system of calculation, it was the civilization that conquered the Greeks, the Romans, who made the first progress in understanding randomness. The Romans generally scorned mathematics, at least the mathematics of the Greeks. In the words of the Roman statesman Cicero, who lived from 106 to 43 BC, the Greeks held the geometer in the highest honor. Accordingly, nothing made more brilliant progress among them than mathematics. But we have established as the limit of this art its usefulness in measuring and counting. Indeed, whereas one might imagine a Greek textbook focused on the proof of congruences among abstract triangles, a typical Roman text focused on such issues as how to determine the width of a river when the enemy is occupying the other bank. With such mathematical priorities, it is not surprising that while the Greeks produced mathematical luminaries like Archimedes, Diophantus, Euclid, Eudoxus, Pythagoras, and Thales, the Romans did not produce even one mathematician. In Roman culture, it was comfort and war, not truth and beauty, that occupied center stage. And yet precisely because they focused on the practical, the Romans saw value in understanding probability. So while finding little value in abstract geometry, Cicero wrote that probability is the very guide of life. Cicero was perhaps the greatest ancient champion of probability. He employed it to argue against the common interpretation of gambling success as due to divine intervention, writing that the man who plays often will at some time or other make a Venus cast. Now and then, indeed, he will make it twice, and even thrice, in succession. Are we going to be so feeble-minded, then, as to affirm that such a thing happened by the personal intervention of Venus, rather than by pure luck? Cicero believed that an event could be anticipated and predicted, even though its occurrence would be a result of blind chance. He even used a statistical argument to ridicule the belief in astrology. Annoyed that although outlawed in Rome, astrology was nevertheless alive and well, Cicero noted that at Cannae in 216 BC, Hannibal, leading about 50,000 Carthaginians and allied troops, crushed the much larger Roman army, slaughtering more than 60,000 of its 80,000 soldiers. "Did all the Romans who fell at Cannae have the same horoscope?" Cicero asked. "It all had one and the same end." Cicero might have been encouraged to know that a couple of thousand years later, in the journal Nature, a scientific study of the validity of astrological predictions agreed with his conclusion. The New York Post, on the other hand, advises today that as a Sagittarius, I must look at criticisms objectively and make whatever changes seem necessary. In the end, Cicero's principal legacy in the field of randomness is the term he used, probabilis, which is the origin of the term we employ today. But it is one part of the Roman Code of Law, the Digest, compiled by Emperor Justinian in the 6th century, that is the first document in which probability appears as an everyday term of art. To appreciate the Roman applications of mathematical thinking to legal theory, one must understand the context. Roman law in the Dark Ages was based on the practice of the Germanic tribes. It wasn't pretty. Take, for example, the rules of testimony. The veracity of, say, a husband denying an affair with his wife's toga maker would be determined not by hubby's ability to withstand a grilling by prickly opposing counsel, but by whether he'd stick to his story even after being pricked by a red-hot iron. Bring back that custom and you'll see a lot more divorce cases settle out of court. And if the defendant says the chariot never tried to stop, but the expert witness says the hoofprints show that the brakes were applied, Germanic doctrine offered a simple prescription. Let one man be chosen from each group to fight it out with shields and spears. Whoever loses is a perjurer, and must lose his right hand. In replacing, or at least supplementing, the practice of trial by battle, the Romans sought in mathematical precision a cure for the deficiencies of their old arbitrary system. Seen in this context, the Roman idea of justice employed advanced intellectual concepts. Recognizing that evidence and testimony often conflicted, and that the best way to resolve such conflicts was to quantify the inevitable uncertainty, the Romans created the concept of half-proof, which applied in cases in which there was no compelling reason to believe or disbelieve evidence or testimony. In some cases, the Roman doctrine of evidence included even finer degrees of proof, as in the church decree that a bishop should not be condemned except with 72 witnesses. A cardinal priest should not be condemned except with 44 witnesses. A cardinal deacon of the city of Rome without 36 witnesses. A subdeacon, acolyte, exorcist, lector, or doorkeeper except with 7 witnesses. To be convicted under those rules, you'd have to have not only committed the crime but also sold tickets. Still, the recognition that the probability of truth in testimony can vary, and that rules for combining such probabilities are necessary, was a start. And so it was in the unlikely venue of ancient Rome that the systematic set of rules based on probability first arose. Unfortunately, it is hard to achieve quantitative dexterity when you're juggling VIIIs and XIVs. In the end, though Roman law had a certain legal rationality and coherence, it fell short of mathematical validity. In Roman law, for example, 2 half-proofs constituted a complete proof. That might sound reasonable to a mind unaccustomed to quantitative thought, but with today's familiarity with fractions, it invites the question, if 2 half-proofs equal a complete certainty, what do 3 half-proofs make? According to the correct manner of compounding probabilities, not only do 2 half-proofs yield less than a whole certainty, but no finite number of partial proofs will ever add up to a certainty because to compound probabilities, you don't add them, you multiply. That brings us to our next law, the rule for compounding probabilities. If 2 possible events, A and B, are independent, then the probability that both A and B will occur is equal to the product of their individual probabilities. Suppose a married person has, on average, roughly a 1 in 50 chance of getting divorced each year. On the other hand, a police officer has about a 1 in 5,000 chance each year of being killed on the job. What are the chances that a married police officer will be divorced and killed in the same year? Well, according to the principle, if those events are independent, the chances would be roughly 1/50th times 1/5,000th, which equals 1 over 250,000. Of course, the events are not independent. They are linked. Once you die, darn it, you can no longer get divorced. And so the chance of that much bad luck is actually a little less than 1 in 250,000. Why multiply rather than add? Suppose you make a pack of trading cards out of the pictures of those 100 guys you've met so far through your internet dating service. Those men who in their website photos often look like Tom Cruise, but in person more often resemble Danny DeVito. Suppose also that on the back of each card you list certain data about the men, such as honest, yes or no, and attractive, yes or no. Finally, suppose that 1 in 10 of the prospective soulmates rates a yes in each case. How many in your pack of 100 will pass the test on both counts? Let's take honest as the first trait. We could equally well have taken attractive. Since 1 in 10 cards lists a yes under honest, 10 of the 100 cards will qualify. Of those 10, how many are attractive? Again, 1 in 10, so now you are left with 1 card. The first 1 in 10 cuts the possibilities down by 1/10, and so does the next 1 in 10, making the result 1 in 100. That's why you multiply. And if you have more requirements than just honest and attractive, you have to keep multiplying, so, well, good luck. Before we move on, it is worth paying attention to an important detail. The clause that reads, if 2 possible events, A and B, are independent. Suppose an airline has 1 seat left on a flight and 2 passengers have yet to show up. Suppose that from experience the airline knows there is a 2 in 3 chance a passenger who books a seat will arrive to claim it. Employing the multiplication rule, the gate attendant can conclude that there is a 2/3 × 2/3, or about a 44% chance, she will have to deal with an unhappy customer. The chance that neither customer will show and the plane will have to fly with an empty seat, on the other hand, is 1/3 × 1/3, or only about 11%. But that assumes the passengers are independent. If, say, they are traveling together, then the above analysis is wrong. The chances that both will show up are 2 in 3, the same as the chances that 1 will show up. It is important to remember that you get the compound probability from the simple ones by multiplying only if the events are in no way contingent on each other. The rule we just applied could be applied to the Roman rule of half-proofs. The chance of 2 independent half-proofs being wrong are 1 in 4. So 2 half-proofs constitute 3/4 of a proof, not a whole proof. The Romans added where they should have multiplied. There are situations in which probabilities should be added, and that is our next law. It arises when we want to know the chances of either one event or another occurring, as opposed to the earlier situation, in which we want to know the chance of one event and another event both happening. The law is this. If an event can have a number of different and distinct possible outcomes, A, B, C, and so on, then the probability that either A or B will occur is equal to the sum of the individual probabilities of A and B and the sum of the probabilities of all the possible outcomes, A, B, C, and so on, is 1. That is 100%. When you want to know the chances that 2 independent events, A and B, will both occur, you multiply. If you want to know the chances that either of 2 mutually exclusive events, A or B, will occur, you add. Back to our airline. When should the gate attendant add the probabilities instead of multiplying them? Suppose she wants to know the chances that either both passengers or neither passenger will show up. In this case, she should add the individual probabilities, which, according to what we've just calculated, would come to 55%. These 3 laws, simple as they are, form much of the basis of probability theory. Properly applied, they can give us much insight into the workings of nature and the everyday world. We employ them in our everyday decision-making all the time, but like the Roman lawmakers, we don't always use them correctly. It is easy to look back, shake our heads, and write books with titles like The Rotten Romans. But lest we become unjustifiably self-congratulatory, I shall end this chapter with a look at some ways in which the basic laws I've discussed may be applied to our own legal system. As it turns out, that's enough to sober up anyone drunk on feelings of cultural superiority. The good news is that we don't have half-proofs today, but we do have a kind of 999,000/1,000,000 proof. For instance, it is not uncommon for experts in DNA analysis to testify at a criminal trial that a DNA sample taken from a crime scene matches that taken from a suspect. How certain are such matches? When DNA evidence was first introduced, a number of experts testified that false positives are impossible in DNA testing. Today, DNA experts regularly testify that the odds of a random person's matching the crime sample are less than 1 in 1 million or 1 in 1 billion. With those odds, one can hardly blame a juror for thinking, throw away the key. But there is another statistic that is often not presented to the jury, one having to do with the fact that labs make errors, for instance, in collecting or handling a sample, by accidentally mixing or swapping samples, or by misinterpreting or incorrectly reporting results. Each of these errors is rare, but not nearly as rare as a random match. The Philadelphia City Crime Laboratory, for instance, admitted that it had swapped the reference sample of the defendant and the victim in a rape case, and a testing firm called Cellmark Diagnostics admitted to a similar error. Unfortunately, the power of statistics relating to DNA presented in court is such that in Oklahoma, a court sentenced a man named Timothy Durham to more than 3,100 years in prison, even though 11 witnesses had placed him in another state at the time of the crime. It turned out that in the initial analysis, the lab had failed to completely separate the DNA of the rapist and that of the victim in the fluid they tested. And the combination of the victim's and the rapist's DNA produced a positive result when compared with Durham's. A later retest turned up the error, and Durham was released after spending nearly 4 years in prison. Estimates of the error rate due to human causes vary, but many experts put it at around 1%. However, since the error rate of many labs has never been measured, courts often do not allow testimony on this overall statistic. Even if courts did allow testimony regarding false positives, how would jurors assess it? Most jurors assume that given the two types of error, the 1 in 1 billion accidental match and the 1 in 100 lab error match, the overall error rate must be somewhere between, say, 1 in 500 million, which is still, for most jurors, beyond a reasonable doubt. But employing the laws of probability, we find a much different answer. The way to think of it is this. Since both errors are very unlikely, we can ignore the possibility that there is both an accidental match and a lab error. Therefore, we seek the probability that one error or the other occurred. That is given by our sum rule. It is the probability of a lab error, 1 in 100, plus the probability of an accidental match, 1 in 1 billion. Since the latter is 10 million times smaller than the former, to a very good approximation, the chance of both errors is the same as the chance of the more probable error, that is, the chances are 1 in 100. Given both possible causes, therefore, we should ignore the fancy expert testimony about the odds of accidental matches and focus instead on the much higher laboratory error rate, the very data courts often do not allow attorneys to present. And so the oft-repeated claims of DNA infallibility are exaggerated. This is not an isolated issue. The use of mathematics in the modern legal system suffers from problems no less serious than those that arose in Rome so many centuries ago. One of the most famous cases illustrating the use and misuse of probability in law is People v. Collins, heard in 1968 by the California Supreme Court. Here are the facts of the case as presented in the court decision. On June 18, 1964, about 11:30 a.m., Mrs. Juanita Brooks, who had been shopping, was walking home along an alley in the San Pedro area of the city of Los Angeles. She was pulling behind her a wicker basket carry-all containing groceries and had her purse on top of the packages. She was using a cane. As she stooped down to pick up an empty carton, she was suddenly pushed to the ground by a person whom she neither saw nor heard approach. She was stunned by the fall and felt some pain. She managed to look up and saw a young woman running from the scene. According to Mrs. Brooks, the latter appeared to weigh around 145 pounds